From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Max Johnston, filling in for April Baer. Today, we'll look at how this pandemic year has looked and felt different in the Upper Peninsula.
Little did we know that we would just have a record-breaking tourism year. I mean, it was extremely busy in Marquette.
We'll also take a look at the difficulties recreational marijuana shop owners have had opening up in Traverse City.
I'm not a fan of caps. I think, you know, we should let the consumers determine whether a business fails or succeeds, and the more competition, the better.
And we'll talk about the return of a West Michigan tradition, tulip time.
So it's just constant planning, looking at the guidelines, replanning, looking at the guidelines, replanning from last September to where we are today.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Max Johnston of Interlochen Public Radio, sitting in for April Baer. Later on the show, we'll look at the slow and controversial creep of recreational marijuana into Traverse City limits. But first, Michigan has the second most number of confirmed COVID-19 variant cases. That's behind Florida. We're also seeing a spike of all COVID cases in the state as regulations are easing and the vaccine is making its way into more communities. Every single person in Michigan has been impacted by this. But the pandemic feels different in communities across the state. Here to illustrate how the pandemic felt in the Upper Peninsula is state lawmaker Sarah Cambenzi. She represents the 109th District, including Marquette, in the State House of Representatives. Representative Cambenzi, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
When did this virus, this pandemic, sort of hit home? I think we all had a moment where we realized what was going on. Looking back to when this started, what was that moment like for you?
You know, it was kind of this moment of anxiety and uncertainty. And, you know, I will say that in the Upper Peninsula, we took it very seriously. There was a complete shutdown at the start of, April, and everyone up here embraced that because we just didn't know a lot about the virus. But as you know, in rural Michigan, you know, only so much time goes by before, if you're a small business owner, you start to worry about how are you going to make ends meet and pay your bills? And it didn't take long before that set in the Upper Peninsula. And you also had anxiety about what is my financial future going to look like if I don't have revenue coming in and people coming to do business at my small business.
So can you describe last summer a bit for me? Because it was an interesting situation in the Upper Peninsula because there was sort of this tenuous balance between having a tourism season, but also fighting a pandemic. So can you just describe what that balance sort of looked and felt like last summer?
Like in most of rural America and certainly rural Michigan, we had a great team of people in the northern lower and certainly the Upper Peninsula that came together and said, we have to all work together to make sure we can have at least a partial reopening to get our businesses some of the revenue they need while keeping everyone safe. And we had economic groups, we had our hospitals, we had our universities and legislators at the table. And we went to the governor and said, you know, as long as we're not seeing that spike up here, can we really work together on, you know, a regional approach that'll keep everyone safe, but allow our businesses to survive. And we were successful with that. And, you know, we not only had record numbers in to the UP and certainly my district that covers Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore, but we also kept people safe. Our numbers were extremely low all throughout the summer. And so it's a sense of pride that we were able to protect people as well as help our small businesses.
In the late summer and into the fall, I remember reading reports about rural hospitals in the Upper Peninsula getting slammed with COVID cases. What did the peak of the pandemic mean for hospitals in the region and in your district?
You know, that was a scary time, I think, for everyone in the Upper Peninsula, because you always assume that that hospital that's in your local community and maybe only 45 minutes away or an hour away is always going to be there for you with, you know, the care and, the capacity that you need. And, you know, that was probably the one thing that really made people realize that when we hit those numbers and when that occupancy wasn't available, people absolutely started to pull back again. We understood that we needed to shut down briefly. And that's really because we not only wanted to protect the workers, our nurses, our physicians, and everyone in the healthcare field, But we also wanted to make sure that if our neighbors who were elderly or needed that more than we did, that we did everything we could to protect that healthcare system and our neighbors.
I want to talk about the communities in the Upper Peninsula and specifically how coronavirus affects these sort of smaller rural communities. I think these smaller areas, you know, it makes coronavirus and this illness feel a little more personal because these are smaller, tighter sort of areas. How does that affect the way the UP has responded to it? How does the coronavirus feel in these small communities where it has a big ripple if only one person gets sick?
Absolutely. I think, you know, whenever there's a funeral in a small town, there tends to be something that you can identify with or some way that you know that person. And that starts to become real a lot quicker maybe than it did in an urban area. So I think that you had, you know, a lot of people that said, oh gosh, you know, I know someone that passed away, or I know of someone in this family that had it and it was really bad. I think you saw a lot of heightened awareness up here when people could identify and actually say that, you know, someone they knew a week or two ago had it and now is no longer with us. I also think it worked the other way, where you had people that might have known someone, but they felt like they didn't know them that well, and they didn't make that personal connection. And you saw a lot of people step up in areas and kind of refuse to wear a mask. And so I think you had both effects up here, but overall, I think what I noticed is that generally people understood that if we do a small part, wear a mask and socially distance, we can help and protect each other, and the likelihood of knowing someone that has had COVID and passed away from it becomes a lot smaller.
So where is the region now? Cases have gone up where I'm at in northern lower Michigan. How are UPers faring right now against the coronavirus in this moment?
You know, I think we're doing good. We did see a big spike, like you said, in the fall. Through the governor's orders, we were able to slow that spread right down. And right after New Year's, you know, our numbers started to head down below the 6% infection rate, getting very close to the 1% where we know it's not really being transmittable. And I think that's why you saw a little bit more COVID fatigue up here. I think people were looking at the local numbers, you know, wanting to reopen and again, you know, help those small businesses, feeling pretty safe about it, knowing the vaccines were coming out, rather than doing an entire statewide approach that the governor kind of stood by in January and February. And, you know, I think right now everyone is feeling really good about it. I'm noticing people are being able to see through the clouds and get to the end of this.
You've been one of the few Democrats that's publicly called for a regional approach to the state's coronavirus response. What about the pandemic and how the people and places in your district have handled it that makes you think a regional approach to this would work?
You know, I think it worked so well for us in the summer. And again, you didn't have, you know, people from the UP coming in and visiting these tourist attractions and places. I mean, we had people from all over the state and country still coming here. And yes, a lot of them are outside a lot more, but we really think that we can, you know, put those protections in place and really manage them and work together. And that, you know, if I could say anything, it's the spirit of people in rural Michigan that really makes it a doable task. And we can do anything when we come together, as long as we, you know, work together and stay together, I think we'll be fine.
So how do you think Governor Whitmer has handled the pandemic overall? Obviously, you advocate for the regional approach, but overall with her administration's response to the pandemic, how do you grade it?
You know, the polling we have seen lately is very low in northern Michigan. It's at about 27% approval rating. And that was pretty shocking to me, even though I've been a little more critical of not being allowed to go back to that regional approach. But I think what it shows, or what it kind of says and speaks to, is we are really close to those local health department officials, and we really rely on those people that we know. They might have been our doctor growing up, or in a medical practice that we went to, that we feel very comfortable trusting their numbers and what they tell us, you know, more than we do outsiders or even people in larger government at the state level. And I think that's why you're seeing people push back a little bit and not be as comfortable with what the governor is suggesting if our region's numbers actually say elsewise.
Is that opinion reflected in the progressives in your district, the people that, you know, may have likely voted for Governor Whitmer as well?
I think so. I think there are a lot of people that voted for her that are disappointed as well. And so I don't think it's a clear line to say that, you know, everyone that voted for her is certainly with her. I think some of them, you know, very moderates that kind of look at the common sense approach, they're the ones that are breaking away and saying, you know, I understand I want to be safe and I want everyone to, you know, keep me safe. But at the end of the day, if the science and the numbers in my region say this, you know, I want to be able to be open and to actually make some money and, you know, not feel like I'm going to lose everything in my business.
What about COVID-19 vaccinations, particularly in some of those smaller rural communities? How has vaccinating your constituents gone?
You know, there was a little, I think, anxiety and certainly frustration at first because so many people, again, have been waiting for these vaccines to get out so they can get vaccinated. And we had such a large number of people that wanted them at first. We just didn't have the supply. And it wasn't unique to the UP or rural Michigan. This was all over the state. We've seen that anxiety go away. Now that more people have it, I think you're watching, certainly those in our community, our seniors get out more, go grocery shopping and really start connecting with people that, you know, it's been almost a year where they lived kind of in solidarity and inside their homes. And so it's a great thing. And I think it's working extremely well. Once we got over the first couple of weeks and everyone was kind of hoping, you know, that they were in that first group of people that would get that vaccine.
We've talked a lot about last summer and how that looked and felt. What about this upcoming summer? We're in an interesting position where more people are getting vaccinated, but some regions are seeing more COVID cases. What does this summer maybe look like right now in the Upper Peninsula? How do you feel about it?
You know, I think this summer is going to be another positive summer for all of our businesses and our communities. And I think with more people getting vaccinated, people are going to travel like they did last summer. And, you know, get out there and enjoy the outdoors. So I feel very positive about it.
Sarah Cambenzi represents the Upper Peninsula's 109th district in the State House. Representative Cambenzi, thanks so much for joining.
Thank you, Max.
Coming up, we'll check in with a business owner in Marquette who 1 year ago was worried the pandemic would flatten his store. That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. You're with Stateside. I'm Max Johnston, in for April Baer. Part of the reason COVID-19 has landed differently with some folks in the Upper Peninsula is because of the ample space. Outdoor recreation up north doesn't usually involve big groups of people. But that doesn't mean that some residents haven't been worried about how the virus might affect them, their friends and family, or their businesses. Bugsy Saylor is the owner of UP Supply Company in Marquette. He joined us last year as things were shutting down, and he also has the favorite name of any source I've ever interviewed. Bugsy, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So the last time we checked in with you was April of last year, and your shop had shut down by that point. You weren't sure what the spring and summer would bring. So sort of bring us up to speed. How was life and business for you in Marquette?
So I can't believe it's been a year already. And it was a year ago this time that I closed the storefront for about 3 months, which was tough, and there's certainly a lot of unknowns. But what happened last year, I mean, all the summer events were canceled, and that gave me a lot of concern that there just wasn't going to be summer tourism here in Marquette, and our shop definitely relies on that traffic. And little did we know that we would just have a record-breaking tourism year. I mean, it was extremely busy in Marquette. And I think a lot of people throughout Michigan and the Great Lakes region were looking for a safe place to travel to, and they had canceled their bigger trips. So a lot of people ended up in the UP.
You mentioned record-breaking numbers. Illustrate that a little bit. What was so record-breaking about last summer?
That kind of comes from talking with a few other business owners, a couple of coffee shop owners that said they had their best summer ever. We had our best month ever during last July as well. So just due to the sheer number of people and the sheer number of traffic in town, the sidewalks are busy all summer long. Frankly, it caught us by surprise. I don't think we prepared our inventory for a super busy summer. I mean, at that point, I was stressed and thinking, you know, like, okay, I've got a little money in the bank. Should I be spending this or saving this right now? And I kind of went down with the saving route, at least for the first part of that year, part of the summer, not expecting that amount of traffic.
How do you think the pandemic sort of looked and felt differently in the Upper Peninsula as opposed to maybe parts downstate? Illustrate that a little bit, especially for listeners that maybe aren't familiar with the region. How did the pandemic just sort of look and feel differently in Michigan's Upper Peninsula?
I think from the beginning, rural communities felt detached because a lot of the news was coming out of larger cities. And of course, a lot of the decisions were being made in Lansing and other state capitals. So when the numbers were spiking everywhere else and we had had no cases, it was understandable that some people were frustrated to have to follow all the mandates when the COVID pandemic hadn't really reached the UP at that point.
And now we're in this position where, you know, people are, I think, preparing to sort of get back out there a little bit. A few weeks ago, some pictures went out of people skating on Lake Superior, which it looked beautiful. The ice on the lake looked like glass. It was a really interesting sight. How did it feel living there and seeing people kind of come out now when we've all been so isolated?
Yeah, so that was this magical moment in Marquette. And we had this winter where there were no events going on. Went through the peak of the pandemic, hopefully, and everybody's been cooped up with nothing to do. And just magically out of nowhere, the ice freezes perfectly in a way that it never does. It does not do that. So you can skate on Superior. And right around the ore dock, which is this magical kind of legendary structure in Marquette. And the entire community just embraced it, and it gave people a way to celebrate the winter, to get outside, and it just really kind of like lifted the spirits of the community, I think, at this really perfect time, and everybody got out there. It was beautiful. It was this wonderful thing. It lined up with my birthday, and I grew up ice skating and playing hockey, so I really appreciated it myself a lot.
Happy belated birthday.
Thanks.
So this idea of nature and space, especially in the Upper Peninsula, tell me how important that has been in getting through this past year for both you and the community, this idea of being able to go out and recreate outdoors. What has that meant for everyone?
Yeah, being in Marquette, you know, we have a ton of access to nature and the outdoors. And I think we're a community that is grateful for that in any given year. But this year, I think a lot of people made a bigger point to spend more time on the trails, finding things to do outside. And the trails, you know, continue to be pretty busy all year. We're blessed with that. And it gives people a great way to socially distance and do something healthy, stretch the legs, get outside. And we're fortunate to have that, and not every community does, but people here certainly embraced it.
Going back to Marquette, it's a bit of a progressive bubble, if you will, in the Upper Peninsula. Did you see or feel any division over COVID restrictions, especially as Republicans in Lansing sort of dug in against Governor Whitmer? Did you feel any division in Marquette over that?
Yes, politically, Marquette is certainly a bubble. You know, in the presidential election, we were the only Upper Peninsula County to turn blue. In Marquette, there was a ton of buy-in with the community with any state mandates. Masks have not been an issue, especially in my little storefront. It's been a smooth process, but it's a different experience in other UP counties, you know, from mask burning parties to manifestos. And it is frustrating to see something like a pandemic so divided along political lines.
So you're originally from a small town called Barriga that has 1,200 residents. What was the pandemic experience like for people there?
Yeah, small town, 70 miles due west of Marquette. And, you know, my parents still live there. But at the beginning of this year, the Berger County commissioners and sheriff wrote a Berger County manifesto, putting the state on notice and saying they were not going to comply with any of the state orders. And that was frustrating for me to hear, with my parents still living there, them becoming of an older generation at more at risk. And we have a lot of family and friends, or friends, I should say, in the area that are an older, riskier demographic, you know, being exposed to COVID. And this came out at the same time where the case numbers were spiking again in Michigan, and then Berger had the highest death rate per capita of all 83 counties in Michigan. So it definitely created a big stir. You know, it was frustrating to me, you know, especially thinking of my parents and my loved ones in the area who I, you know, want to be protected and looked after.
Do you feel that manifesto just generally reflects the sentiment of the residents and the surrounding communities or not?
Yes. And it definitely falls along that political bounds, and Berger County being one of the more conservative counties in the entire state, I believe, if you look at the presidential election versus, you know, Marquette being on the more liberal side. So it is frustrating when something like COVID, you know, has no political preference, you know, in who will become ill or die from it. So it is frustrating that it has been drawn so many political lines and in small, tight-knit communities. You know, there's certainly a lot of travel between Berger and Marquette County.
On vaccinations, have you been vaccinated yet? Or do you know many people who have?
I myself have not. My parents have had at least one shot each at this point. I know more and more people kind of slowly closer to my age and demographic who have gotten the vaccine. And I've read initial numbers that over 100,000 people in the UP have gotten at least one shot, which is fantastic. I think the vaccine numbers are doing really well across the UP.
Are you breathing a sigh of relief that your parents are on their way to being fully vaccinated?
Yes, absolutely. And my grandmother as well, who lives in the Lower Peninsula and who is 90. So yes, every time I see a friend or a first line worker, something like that in my inner circle who got the vaccine, I feel a little more comfort myself, and I'm glad, hoping that they do as well, you know, that they can breathe a little easier and get to this finish line.
Looking ahead to this summer, what do you think this summer will look like? We're in an interesting position where more people are getting vaccinated, but COVID is still very much in our lives. What do you think this summer will look like in the Upper Peninsula?
I kind of feel we're in the same place as a year ago in some regard. I think you get to spring and naturally people are excited. The longer days, get out and about to do something, you know, school years finishing up. So I do think there's going to be a big influx in tourism again. I think it will be bigger numbers than we're used to. If that means more than last year, we'll find out. But hopefully the vaccine helps. I mean, people are going to travel regardless, and you know, we'll see what we can maintain. You know, back to my little shop, and I think the community in Marquette, as far as masks and mandates go, everybody's been very wonderful in terms of complying with the orders. So we'll just see how long we have to keep wearing masks, and hopefully we see decrease.
Bugsy Saylor is the owner of UP Supply Co. in Marquette. Bugsy, thanks so much for joining Stateside.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you.
As many of us feel a cautious optimism that the end of a lockdown pandemic is in sight, one marker of spring in Michigan is Holland's Tulip Time Festival. While it was put on hold last year, like so many other festivals, it's back this year, the first week of May. But there won't be huge crowds like normal. We're joined by Tulip Time's executive director, Glenn Auerda, to talk about what people can expect this year. Glenn, welcome back to Stateside.
Well, thank you for having me.
So you spoke with us last year during this time when Tulip Time was canceled. How are you feeling about reopening this year?
We are feeling great. You know, the tulips go in the ground in the fall, so we've been already thinking about the festival since October when we helped the city plant all the tulips. So it's they're starting to peek up through the dirt now, which is normal for this time of year. We're really excited, really, to celebrate spring in the next 6-7 weeks.
And so I wanted to ask about what happened with the tulips from last year, because they don't stop growing because of a virus. Can you tell me just like what goes into the growing process and the sourcing of this, how you did it, and especially with having to cancel last year?
Yeah, so the city plants all of the tulips in all the city parks for the festival. We put on the events around the festival, but the city plants all the tulips. All the tulip bulbs are imported from the Netherlands. They arrive here sometime in the middle of September, and they get in the ground by early November. And then they sleep all winter, which is what they're supposed to do, and they start to sprout and grow. And when the snow melts, you will start to see the leaves popping up through the dirt. And it takes another 2 months for them to really grow fully and get to the point of blooming. It depends on how cold it is at night and how warm during the day as to exactly when they come out and bloom. But typically we see them the end of April for the first couple of weeks of May, which is how we determine when the festival is going to be.
Okay. So the city was still beautiful last year, even though the festival wasn't on. But tell me about those of us who haven't been to Tulip Time before. Tell us about just what it looks like.
So Tulip Time is a festival that celebrates our Dutch heritage. That's how the community was formed, was from the Dutch that came from the Netherlands. The flower tulips, which is really known as a Dutch flower. And then the local community that we have today. Typically, we'll have parades. We'll have some authentic Dutch dancing, a carnival, a 5 and 10K run that has 3,000 to 4,000 people running together. And just lots of activities. We have shows at night, entertainment, and so forth. This year's very different with the guidelines that continue to change sometimes once a month. And it's been really hard to really figure out where we would be this May when we started planning last fall. And some of those plans we put in place last fall, we've had to really pivot and do something different this year. For example, the run, we're unable to do the run in person. The guidelines from the State Health Department say only 300 people can gather for a specific 5K run. Well, when you have 3,000 to 4,000 come, that isn't quite possible. So we've turned the run into a virtual event. The same thing with our artisan market that draws thousands of people. We've turned that into a virtual event, which people can still look at all those vendors through our website and see what they would like to purchase. The vendors have their own websites. They have their own Etsy shops, and you can buy directly from them and have it shipped to you. So just a different way to do the artisan market, but a way in which we've had to pivot to be able to still host that event.
I want to sort of hone in there a little bit. Your planning process in all this, being able to pivot with regulations changing, what were your main considerations going into this, the main hurdles you had to jump through with these regulations shifting and really ultimately to be able to hold this event? Can you just illustrate what that process sort of looked like?
Normally, we're planning anywhere from 12 to 15 months in advance. So this year has been very different. We really nailed down by fall, which was in the September timeframe, that we thought we could do outside events. As we got through the summer, everyone kept saying, health department, all those guidelines was get outside, be outside. It's safe. It's fine. Wear your mask, use social distancing. So we planned those outside events and we spent most of the winter planning those events and being able to handle those and the crowds that come and keep people safe. And then, of course, 4 weeks ago, some of that changed and we had to pivot again and turn those events into virtual events. So it's just constant planning, looking at the guidelines, replanning, looking at the guidelines, replanning from last September to where we are today.
And so you obviously have this plan now, but are you expecting or hoping that more regulations will be lifted before the festivities sort of begin?
I am hoping that they will be lifted, but the problem for us now is when we plan a year in advance, we can't add some of these events 4 weeks before the festival. The current guidelines go up until April 19. So if anything would open up further, for example, we would be unable to pull a parade off in 2 weeks' time. So we're kind of where we are in terms of the planning and the events that we can do, and again, do safely within the guidelines. So we're hoping that people just take the approach of, I'm going to come, I'm going to stay safe, and I'm going to, allow the festival to do what it does within the scope of what we can do today. And it's hard. Some days it's disheartening because, we're used to putting on a big party and all these other events, but we really believe we can do it safely and we can enjoy outside and the tulips and our community and people will come. They came last year, even though, we were all under stay home order, the tulips bloomed, people still came.
How can people best stay up to date on the plans and sort of changes to the festival ahead of it?
look at our website. It changes every day. If we add an event, things will be loaded on there. We have to do time ticketing for any of our events. And so we are asking people to go on the website, order your tickets, print them off, keep them in your email, so we can have as much contactless check-in as possible. But time tickets are really key because we have to, in some cases, only have 250 people inside our civic center where we'll have a Dutch market. And so you have to know, I don't want people standing outside for 2 hours to get in. So getting your time ticket in advance is very helpful. Our website has all that information. It's tuliptime.com. And you can look at what days you're here and what availability is out there for tickets. And you can participate easily that way.
Holland's Tulip Time Festival is this year from May 1st to May 9th. Gwen Auerda is the executive director of Holland's Tulip Time Festival. Thanks so much for joining Stateside.
Thank you.
Still to come, cannabis sales are doing great across Michigan. But some towns, like my home of Traverse City, are still deciding how to proceed.
Municipalities should stop blaming the legislation for refusing to move forward on this. You know, there are plenty of communities that were not confused and didn't have a problem enacting an ordinance and implementing it.
Potentially a new green in northern Michigan. That's after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Max Johnston, filling in for April Baer. Recreational marijuana was legalized in Michigan over 2 years ago, but you still can't buy it in Traverse City, even though 12 new businesses are ready to sell it. Now, dispensary owners are suing the city, hoping to cash in on what could be a big tourism season. Paula Hagen runs one of those dispensaries, Green Farms, that's spelled with a PH. She says she's turning a lot of customers away.
Constantly, probably 50 to 100 people a day.
These are people who want recreational marijuana, but Green Farms, along with every other dispensary in Traverse City, can only sell medical marijuana. So Hagen sends these customers to their store in nearby Kalkaska. Recreational sales are allowed there. But she does one other thing first.
We do have a petition. It says, help us go recreational by signing this petition for Traverse City. There's hundreds and hundreds of signatures on that.
Traverse City's 12 dispensaries are beautiful buildings. Most have big, bright signs and sleek storefronts. And it briefly looked like Traverse City would allow recreational marijuana sales last summer. The city commission came up with a whole rubric for dispensaries to open, but they capped the number of recreational shops in town at 4. Commissioner Brian McGillivary said they could take it slow.
You know, we can always expand it, so let's start small and work our way up.
Traverse City's existing dispensaries hated this plan and quickly sued. A judge banned sales until that settled. Mike DeLora runs House of Dank, another dispensary eager to sell recreational marijuana. DeLora worked with Traverse City officials on medical marijuana, which he says went well, but slowly.
Traverse City from the start has been taking this, you know, very seriously, and they've done a really good job with the existing stores to ensure compliance.
So he assumed the city would use the same process for recreational marijuana. And he was stunned when they proposed limiting the number of dispensaries to 4.
Most municipalities don't decide that based on their population, they only need 3 coffee spots. We will allow you to decide if you can compete in our marketplace.
And not only would a select few be allowed to sell recreational marijuana, but there would be a number of hoops to jump through. Dispensaries would be scored on various criteria. A higher score would increase the chances of becoming one of the lucky 4. For instance, extra points would be awarded to dispensaries that build affordable housing.
And we took a look. We hired an architect to take a look at some residential housing. It looked like Frankenstein above my store, all right? Like, it just doesn't make any sense to stuff apartments on top of this.
Michigan's recreational marijuana law does allow cities to set these criteria. It's a so-called merit-based system. A couple places in Michigan have been sued for doing this, including Traverse City. So now the courts must decide what's a fair definition of merit.
What you might perceive as something that's beneficial, someone else might perceive differently.
That's Matt Abel. He's the executive director of Michigan Normal, a marijuana advocacy group. Abel helped write the law that legalized recreational marijuana in Michigan. He says they wrote it to empower cities so they would embrace recreational sales. It's done that in some spots. In others, it's spawned lawsuits.
It's gone slower than many of us would have preferred, but it is moving.
Traverse City's rules are being litigated. City officials couldn't comment for this story, citing that lawsuit. And the clock is ticking. Mike DeLora at House of Dank says, if they can't sell recreational marijuana, most of Traverse City's dispensaries will close within a year. He hopes something will change before Memorial Day.
This is likely going to be the most lucrative travel season in Michigan's history.
DeLora says if city officials are looking for how to sell weed safely, his answer is, let us do it.
We've been here a year. There's been no trouble. I mean, nothing's changed. You know, Traverse City is still this world-class town that people want to visit and live in. And cannabis hasn't altered that.
In the meantime, the state already gave out nearly $10 million to communities that allow recreational sales. Nearby Benzie and Kalkaska counties each got over $80,000 for their shops. Traverse City got nothing. In that story, you heard from attorney Matt Abel. He joins me again to talk about how places like Traverse City ended up in this situation with recreational marijuana. Matt, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks so much, Max. Great to be here.
So overall, since the recreational law passed a couple years ago, how would you say the recreational marijuana industry is doing?
Well, it's gearing up slowly but steadily. I think one of the major holdups has been that so few municipalities have passed ordinances allowing adult use facilities in their jurisdictions. But as time goes on, we see every month a few more places that pass ordinances and allow facilities. And so it is, the numbers are creeping up. I think currently there are around 50 or so municipalities that are allowing adult use. We're at maybe 150 on the recreational side. So we at least expect most of those that have allowed medical facilities also to allow adult use facilities.
And so, as you mentioned, a lot of shops have opened up across the state and a lot of entrepreneurs are now getting into this business. I've heard reports of prices dropping for cannabis pretty severely in some places. Have we seen a tipping point yet of supply versus demand for marijuana overall?
Well, we're starting to. It certainly fluctuates where commercial cannabis was up at maybe $4,000 a pound, and now it's closer to $2,000 a pound through the, you can tell through the tracking system with the state of Michigan. But part of that may be that we're still seeing the results of the harvest from the fall. Eventually, the market will flood. We're still seeing more and more growers coming online. But along with that, paralleling that, we're seeing more and more retail stores open. And so we're still increasing in the number of consumers in Michigan, because as people see a retail store nearby or are become aware of it, they'll go there and patronize the store. And so demand still is increasing. At some point, demand is going to level out, where everyone who wants cannabis is able to get it. And then the price is going to continue to go down. I think we have a couple of years at least before the market settles to a stable price.
Sort of on that note, do prices with marijuana fluctuate seasonally like other commodities? Like as people spend more time outside or go on vacation, I would assume more product is moved off the shelves. Does that have an impact on some of the price here?
I can't say for sure. I'm not up on those stats, but there are seasonal fluctuations for sure. Partly, you know, we've had the pandemic for the last year, and so travel and tourism has been much reduced. But just recently, I've had several people approach me talking about the opportunities for expanded cannabis retail businesses due to tourism and the tourist economy, and how to align it with recreational activities. For example, you know, some people, they don't just want to go canoeing, they want to consume some cannabis and go canoeing.
And some of the legal disputes in communities in places like Traverse City are over this merit-based approach that they've taken to getting dispensaries in town. I wanted to ask you specifically on that. There's been a lot of confusion, lawsuits over the merit-based approach. Is this tension on this point? Is this a problem of us under-regulating marijuana or over-regulating it? How would you classify it?
I'm not sure how to answer that question, if it's over under regulation. The law says that if a municipality puts a cap on the number of any type of licenses, that they need to determine who is best suited to have those limited licenses. Some have much more extensive and strict rubrics, if you will, that score the applications. Others much more simple. And that tends to be the place where people who lose in that selection process object to the scoring and the way that it's handled, that there is no consistent scoring system statewide. Sometimes the municipality will put things in their scoring, such as the person owns a local business, which doesn't really say anything about whether they're best suited, other than the community determined we're best suited. You know, the people who are best suited are people who will keep the money in this community. And maybe there is something to that. And sometimes the person who's best suited is, you know, the nephew of the township supervisor. It comes out that way sometimes. So I'm not a fan of caps. I think, you know, we should let the consumers determine whether a business fails or succeeds. And the more competition, the better. And the communities that do have scoring, who get into trouble, they end up being sued by losers, or people who were not awarded the licenses, put it that way. And so some of those communities, like Warren, had to completely redo their evaluation process because one of the city council people who was on the scoring committee was scoring I think it was 15 licenses to be awarded. They scored their 15 favorites at 100% and then scored everybody else at a very low number. And so that the court determined that wasn't an individualized evaluation of the adequacy of or appropriateness of that application. And so they're having to go back through that scoring system. And some of the municipalities, having seen this, now outsource the grading of these to an independent, like an accountant, a CPA, who would hopefully, you know, not use emotion in here, but just hopefully objective scoring so that they can actually determine who's best suited. And then if there's a lawsuit over someone who's unhappy with their evaluation, they end up suing the CPA or the evaluating firm rather than suing the municipality.
So Traverse City officials have blamed the state's recreational law itself for some of this. They say they got to wait for the courts to figure it out because the law is new and it has things in it that are contradictory. They've said these in city commission meetings. I want to ask you, you were involved with drafting the bill. Do you think that holds any weight?
No, I don't. I think that people are using that as an excuse to refuse to implement the system. I think certainly there are things that could be clarified and expanded upon, but the bones of it are there, and it's not that hard to understand, and that municipalities should stop blaming the legislation for refusing to move forward on this. Certainly, you know, there are plenty of communities that were not confused and didn't have a problem enacting an ordinance and implementing it. So, you know, and if they have suggestions for improvements, those certainly should go to the legislature. I know there's been discussion about combining the licensing systems for the medical marijuana program and the adult use program. And I think they're up to draft 7 in that, or they were. Some people think it's really just the large providers who are always trying to squeeze out the smaller entities and the smaller providers. Some people think that there are folks who want to wipe out the caregiver and patient system, where caregivers can supply patients with medicine. We want to protect home growing. Not every state that has legal cannabis has the right to grow plants in your household. I'd like to see that expanded, frankly. Someone who rents an apartment where the manager or the owner prohibits growing is not allowed to grow anywhere. So I'd like to see us use this to build a better society, both to create a lot of jobs, which clearly it is doing, to raise tax money, which clearly it is doing. And then the things that people don't see as much, which is that statistically, we know now that in places with retail cannabis stores where people have access, not just where it's legal, but where people have access, that overdoses and deaths from opiates are at a reduced rate. While cannabis in itself may or may not be safe, and I think it is, no one ever has died from cannabis. And now that we've had medical marijuana for over a decade, people can see that the sky has not fallen. And now that if grandma eats a cookie, she can sleep and everybody's good with that. Nobody turned into an axe murderer. So it's all good.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Matt Abel. He's an attorney with the Michigan Cannabis Council and Normal. Matt, I saw a figure that was jarring the other day, and it said that as of last year, the state of Michigan still had 250,000 residents that still had marijuana convictions on their record. I wanted to ask you, is there any concrete movement to expunge those?
Well, yes. In fact, the legislature has passed a bill that takes effect April 1st that will at least make the availability of expungement much more broad to a large subset of people. Under the old law, people were not eligible for expungement if they had more than one felony and more than one misdemeanor. At this point, people are eligible even if they have multiple offenses. There's the one bad night scenario where someone is convicted of a number of crimes from one incident, and those are now expungible. And as far as the cannabis crimes, certainly anything that is not now a crime should not be on someone's record. And we are continuing to move forward and to press the legislature to make that effective more quickly.
So I always thought it was kind of strange that people can make money off marijuana, but at another moment, someone wouldn't be able to get a job because of it. Would that dynamic still be at play after April 1st?
Yes, unfortunately. Michigan is an at-will employment state, meaning anyone can be fired for any reason that isn't prohibited by law, like gender, race, religion, national origin. Being a cannabis consumer is not a protected category, and Michigan has no employment status protection for people who are cannabis users. Now, we expect that as time goes on, more and more companies are finding that it's difficult to hire people who can pass a drug test, a pre-employment drug test, because of cannabis. And so at Normal, one of the frequent complaints we get or requests for action is people who have sensitive jobs, who are employed, for example, in the transportation industry as a truck driver, let's say, who has to test on demand. But if they have 3 days off and they consume some cannabis, they're going to be dirty for a month, perhaps. And somebody's status when they're not working shouldn't matter. One of the problems up to this point has been that we haven't had really good ways to do impairment testing at the job site, but there are beginning to be some apps. There's a UMass professor who developed an app called Druid, D-R-U-I-D, that is kind of a game that someone might play on a laptop. And so every time they clock in for work, they need to play this game, and the game determines whether their reactions are slower than normal. It does what employers say they want, which is to have a sober workforce, but it also protects the rights of consumers, adults who want to consume cannabis on their off hours.
Matt Abel is an attorney with the Michigan Cannabis Council and Normal. Matt, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. I appreciate it, Max.
And that's the show for today. Stateside is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Newhen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm Max Johnston of Interlochen Public Radio in for April Bear. Thanks so much for listening. Back with more from Stateside tomorrow.